This edition of Culture was first broadcast on the 18th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the 110th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today's show is a patchwork quilt, a mosaic of international tiles, a Byzantine presentation, flitting like an elegant moth to the moon of all that is arts. We've been around. The world's biggest photography fair has just come to a close. We'll explore the highlights of Paris Photo 2013.
I try to make sure that there is a flow of energy moving from a young, unknown gallery to a more established, to this kind of work and artist, you know, I want you to get lost.
We'll get an exclusive on the Couldn't Be Newer Jumex Museum in Mexico City.
If we have many great institutions, we will have a great art scene, and there will be a lot of art production in this country.
We'll also be meeting a couple of literary legends. We'll sit down for coffee with Peru's Santiago Roncalliolo and celebrate the 90th birthday of South African Nobel laureate Nadim Gordimer.
You cannot train to be a writer. I know this shocks people, but it's something that is just there and that you then have the urge to use.
And if that weren't enough, we'll also be getting back to basics for this week's a cappella Midori House session and visiting a very homely gallery in Miami. That's all to look forward to here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First then, some music to brighten your ears. And for this week's live session, we were joined by the wonderful a cappella group Vive for some authentic six-part vocal harmony here at Midori House. All jazz musicians from London's Guildhall School of Music, bar one, who the group discovered on YouTube, Vive are picking up where Take Six, the Swingle Singers, and the Yale University's legendary Whiffen Poofs left off. I'm talking about highly intricate vocal harmonies mixed with beatbox and a touch of sass. They kick things off with their own original track, Voices.
Walking round with my doubt, who'd have thought it'd be me? People come, people go, but let no eye to help see. While looking forward in time, I find it difficult to see the signs. Looking forward to all your love. Lose your mind in my voice. Sanity is a choice. Dreams come true when you see them through. Life is tough, but we'll get by.
It's always me, never you. And now is the time to start anew. I'm changing up all my blues. No more friends to miss you. To see the signs, looking forward to all your love. Do you lose your mind in my voice? Sanity is a choice. Dreams come true when you see them through. Life is tough, but we'll get by. Lose your mind in my voice, in my voice. Sanity is a choice. Dreams come true when you see them through.
Life is tough, but we'll get by.
That was a cappella group Aviv with Voices, the first of three tracks we'll be bringing you throughout the show. Well, in a moment we'll be explaining why I'm in Mexico, but first we're crossing the channel to head to the French capital. You guessed it, we're headed to Paris Photo, the largest photography fair in the world that just finished its 17th edition in the City of Lights. Last year I took you on a stroll around the alleys of the Grand Palais and I went along to the first ever Paris Photo outside of Paris in Los Angeles. So what should we get excited about this year? Well, we sent our own Daphne Denis to find out more.
It's about selling prints, of course. But it would be unfair to only look at Paris Photo as a venue for galleries, 136 of them this year, to make big bucks. Since he started in the job 3 years ago, Paris Photo director Julien Friedman has turned the largest photo fair in the world into a conversation about photography as a medium and collecting as an art in and of itself.
Well, I guess now there is a clear understanding that photography is not only a question of whether it's black and white or color, or whether it's a large frame or a small frame. We try to make sure that the audience see the variety, the diversity of the languages.
The diversity of languages can be heard on the alleyways too. Galleries from 24 countries have made it under the stupendous glass vault of the Grand Palais. Needless to say, walking around on the hunt for fine prints can prove a little dizzying. There's no order, no line, just photos, photo books, and more photos as far as the eye can see. The point is, you shouldn't be looking for something specific. You should stumble upon photos that grab you instead.
We try to make sure that there is not sections in the fair where you would look for older pieces or modern or contemporary. I try to make sure that there is a flow of energy moving from a young, unknown gallery to a more established, to this kind of work and artist. So it's really about trying to, I want you to get lost.
So let's get lost, shall we? And let's start by the end, away from the galleries, up the spiral stairs of the Palais. Here, one infamous private collector, Harold Falkenberg, has been invited to show his favorite photographs.
See, the line is that I understand, or the artists I collect don't understand art as a part of the culture, but art as pointed against culture. If art becomes old, and is accepted everywhere, then it is culture. They want to work at a stage where art is not yet culturized.
At 70 years old, Hamburg-based Falkenberg is one of the most avant-garde collectors of his time. In his collection, you can spot a couple of classic pictures by Walker Evans or Lee Friedlander. But most of the works here aren't pretty or aesthetic. This collection is about conceptual art, even ugly art, Falkenberg says.
You can go piece by piece, and you never would evaluate any of these subjects as culturally valuable. They are not valuable, and that is the point. They don't want to be valuable in the cultural sense.
The Falkenberg collection is first and foremost about contemporary art, not only photography. And his presence here today shows how much the demographic of Paris Photo has changed over the past years. We've gone back down to the gallery area, and this is Benjamin Trigano, the owner of LA's M+B Contemporary Art Gallery.
I think it's expanded the medium, it's broadened the conversation, and now you have everybody who's participating, and you have galleries like David Zwinner, Gagosian, 303, Metro Pictures that I don't think ever considered doing this fair and that are now coming and understand how relevant it is.
Now, we're at the Paris Photo platform, a large auditorium where French art legends Sophie Calle, is having a chat with Quentin Bajac, chief curator of the Department of Photography at the MoMA in New York.
J'ai été invité à exposer, représenter la France pour la Biennale de Venise avec le projet Prenez soin de vous. La règle en France.
Carl is here to discuss her work, art that's based on photos she doesn't always take. Is she a photographer? Not really, she says, and that's despite having won the Hasselblad Award, the rough equivalent of the Nobel Prize for Photography. The conversation here revolves once again around the fine line between conceptual art and pictures, and how one can seamlessly fit into the other. So how else is Paris Photo challenging its public to think about images? For the second year in a row, the organisers of the fair want you to look away from the walls and inside photo books too. They have joined forces with New York's Aperture Foundation to give out two photo book awards.
Really, the initial creative inspiration came from Julian Friedman, who's the director of Paris Photo. He's a book lover. He wanted to be able to bring a greater attention to the book form as an important means of photographers displaying their work, distributing their work, and really the photo book as an art object in and of itself as an important part of contemporary practice.
Leslie Martin, Aperture's publisher, walks me through the central alley of the fair, where the works selected for the award of the first photo book of the year and best photo book of the year are on show. The selection goes from classic presentations to more daring ideas, like Delphine Burtin's self-published En couble paraître.
There are small inserted pieces of paper, the pages are doubled over in what we call Japanese binding.
Or the winning photo book of the year, Karma by Oscar Monzon.
This is a very slick object. All the pages have this hyper glossy sheen to them. I mean, you can almost see yourself in the pages. And it's this very tightly, almost claustrophobic, edited piece of work. Close-ups of cars, close-ups of faces, close-ups of people in cars.
Close the books, and there's still more to see. Like three institutions from Brazil, Canada, and Germany, showing their most recent acquisitions in three specially curated exhibitions. Julien Friedman says this is all meant to teach people how to look at photography with fresh eyes.
I wanted to make sure that people realize that there are so many ways to collect photography, and that by showing what the museum are doing around the world, you know, approach. This year we have the Instituto Moreira Salles from Brazil, and they are working on Brazilian artists, and they are showing us this approach that they have is not the only one, but about the evolution of the urbanistic development of Brazil. But you can look at others like Wolfgang from Essen, Germany, puts into perspective work that they received from Magnum photographer from the 50s that were covering events around the world, and those black and white beautiful prints in relation with recent coverage of, you know, Place Tahrir in Egypt. That is a way of thinking about the power of the medium. And if a museum is doing that, a collector can do it, and the collector can walk around the fair and feel comfortable about buying some anonymous vintage press print because they suddenly have a theme and feel, but I want people to feel confident about it.
Not such a disorganized event after all. And if you feel like having a browse through Paris Photo's galleries, you don't have to wait much longer. Rendezvous next April in Los Angeles for the American version of the fair. For Monaco, in Paris, I'm Daphne Denis.
Merci, Daphne. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Okay, so here's what I did on my holidays. Only joking, it was really hard work. Welcome to Mexico City, where the great and the good of the art world and beyond have had their breath bated for the opening of the Museo Jumex. It's a new museum built by David Chipperfield, filled with pieces from the collection of the Lopez family, and opening this week. Largely the baby of Eugenio Lopez, the youngish heir to the family's fruit juice fortune, the collection is the most respected booty of Mexican, South American, and international contemporary art in Latin America. I was given a tour by Museo Jumex's director, Patrick Chaclanel.
What we are looking at is a big, very important selection of work from the Jumex collection. And at the same time, there is another exhibition that is overlapped. That is a Fred Sandbach, mm-hmm. with strings.
Yeah.
Exhibition that is almost invisible, very transparent, very pure. So we have these two two experiences.
One. Yes, there's some very solid stuff in here that takes up space, and there's something rather ethereal about these strings.
Yes. The works from the collection have a very strong physical presence. They all deal in a different way with the idea of collapsing. Things are in the border to collapse. And the other is totally stable, even if it's very, almost invisible, it's very stable, very pure. It gives a kind of a structure, architectural structure to the gallery. So there are these two opposite experiences that you can have.
And do you see people reacting strangely to these works? I guess it's early days in this museum right now, but do people sort of dodge out of the way of this? Do people perceive it as a wall?
I hope not. I hope not. No, it's a good question. I have no idea how will the public react. It's something that we'll see in a few days. But I think one of the shows, the one with the works from the collection, just gives a very general idea of what Humex has been collecting for the last years, the last decade. And Fred Samak, as I was mentioning, it's all around. You will see strings in every corner of the gallery. And they give a very interesting structure. They have a very interesting way to deal and to connect with the work of the exhibitions. But at the same time, they are very big scale works. They're almost invisible.
What about the building itself? We're standing in a pretty beautiful building. A lot's been said about it, and it seems like a bit of an oasis in the middle of some rather more muscular architecture around it, perhaps. What does that mean? What does it mean working in a brand new space? I mean, it must be wonderful for you as a director of something like this to have this place to play with.
Well, first, it was designed by David Chipperfield, which is a British architect that has already designed Museum of Contemporary Art, so he has experience in the understanding and the intelligence to design exhibitions, spaces, museums. Second, I think there are three important virtues of this building. One of them is that in this very noisy area where there's a different kind of constructions, he decided to do a very simple, elegant and silent building. In terms of materials, in terms using local materials, so it was really, really nice. This is a marble travertine that comes from Veracruz in Mexico. And the stone is a very important element in the history of art in Mexico in the pre-Columbian times. The second thing is that he built very flexible galleries.
So you can move walls and rearrange it for exhibitions?
Not like other museums where the architect imposes very specific conditions for exhibitions and artists and curators have to deal with them. Here he really built a very flexible, two very flexible galleries that can be transformed in any way imaginable. And it's really about the artist and the creator will be able to do whatever they want when they conceive and produce exhibitions. The third virtue is that it has a human scale. It's not a very big museum. In one visit, you can experience the totality of this, of the program.
It sounds like you're trying to engage with everybody. You want everyone to come through these doors to learn something, to see what maybe they've missed as well in the last 20, 30 years of Mexican art as well, right?
Well, Mexico, very few people know that, is the city that has the biggest amount of museums in the world. Second is Los Angeles, it's not New York, it's not London, it's not Paris. It's first Mexico, second Los Angeles in terms of quantity of museums. But it's not about quantity, it's also a museum like Tamayo, a museum like MUAC, if we're talking about contemporary art museums, they not only have great buildings with really good conditions for exhibiting contemporary artworks, but also they have a very good program. So I think Mexico has become lately a very important capital, not only for museum exhibitions, but also for art production. So this obviously is bringing something new to the city in the very high quality standards. But this will complement the scene, the museum scene and the artist scene in Mexico.
Is it a competitive scene? Are you jostling each other out of the way?
No, the proof is through our program of grants, we're supporting all the other museums. What will be the only reason why we are supporting other contemporary institutions is because we really, really believe that if we have great institutions and if we have many great institutions, we will have a great art scene. And there will be a lot of art production in this country.
Are you always keen to see how people interact with the museum as the director of it? When it opens to the public, how people look, how long they look, what they talk about. It's always interesting to see people interacting with your own show, with your own space, right?
It's very important for me that it doesn't become a spectacle or a place where you show your historical or artistic trophies, but the opposite thing is a platform of research, experimentation, where instead of legitimizing, you problematize the things. So really people don't come to see like the object that you cannot touch.
But you come, Ozymandias.
But you really come to be critical, to be open. I'm always very inspired by the model of universities, where there is education, research, all kind of experience, but also an institution that assumes a position. So I hope we will, as universities do, that's where political movements always begin in, from universities. I hope that we will become an institution that also assumes a position.
That was Patrick Charpenel, director of the Museo Jumex, talking to me in Mexico City last week. The museum opens this week with a show from the Permanent Collection, an exhibition on James Lee Byers, and a brand new commission by Mexico's own Demian Ortega. And this is Culture on Monocle 24. We'll meet a Nobel laureate next.
Cityscapes have inspired filmmakers for generations, and this year we sent a film crew to the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam to explore common themes found in building real and imaginary worlds.
In film, you can tell what's behind the walls. You can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects. And as filmmakers, in essence, are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can tell what's behind the facade.
Passion, obsession, idealism, architecture on film. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Old age is not an achievement, it's about what you've achieved in your life, Nadine Gordimer said to Nelson Mandela when he turned 90. This week, the prominent South African writer is reaching the same milestone herself. Nadine Gordimer has been one of the most influential voices from South Africa, both in terms of her writing and as a political activist. In 1991, she was awarded with the Nobel Prize for Literature and was described as an author who, through her magnificent epic writing, has been a very great benefit to humanity. Today, approaching her 90th birthday and nearly 20 years after the first democratic elections in her home country, she stays vocal and politically active, and Leonie March had the privilege of meeting her at home in Johannesburg.
Nadine Gordimer lives in a leafy neighborhood in Johannesburg, close to the city center but far from the bustle. She's a tiny old lady and appears frail, slowly walking with a stick through her huge house. But her mind is still razor sharp. She's still writing every morning.
It's been the drive in my life. You know, writers, you cannot train to be a writer. I know this shocks people. But it's something that is just there and that you then have the urge to use.
Nadine Gordimer started writing as a child, growing up in a small mining town outside Johannesburg. Her mother, fearing she had a weak heart, took her out of school at an early age. Homebound and often isolated, Gordimer fled into the world of books.
I have been, from the age of 6, a great reader, a voracious reader. Fortunately, my mother read to me when I was little. And then, as I grew up, the libraries meant everything to me. If you've got the instinct to write, then it will be nurtured and brought out in you by reading. You start discovering in yourself the power of the word and how it fits certain things that you feel or that you imagine somebody else feeling. And that's where the creation of characters comes from.
The characters in her books all live in her home country, South Africa. During apartheid, Gordimer wrote about the complicated personal and social relationships, the interplay between races, racial conflict, and the pain inflicted by the unjust laws.
If you are a writer, you are in exploration of life, what it's all about, what it all really is. Your whole life, all of us, is contained by the laws and the social attitudes of the country in which we live. And of course, I happened to be born into a country where these things were intense and conflicting.
uncovering these conflicts meant to oppose the racist regime. Several of her books were banned in South Africa. But Gordimer isn't a person that's easily intimidated. She's got a reputation for intellectual rigor bordering on fierceness. Being a prominent, award-winning writer, well known beyond South Africa, she used her influence and actively supported the ANC.
And of course I take up political positions as a human being, as I've had to do living as a white person in a country that had terrible oppression. How can you stand aside when there's unrest, and when there is indeed oppression in your country?
The time when apartheid ended was one of the happiest in her life. She still vividly remembers the day of the first democratic elections in 1994. But Gordimer regrets that no one, including herself, at that time expected the long-lasting legacy of the racial segregation.
I was very delighted and remain to the fact that we managed to, and I in my small contribution, very small compared with others, to bring about change. We got rid of apartheid. But of course, I think we were rather naive in thinking that once apartheid was gone, everybody's going to be wonderful to each other. There'll be no racial prejudice. There'll be no oppression of any kind, just by saying, we've got the vote. But it was wonderful to get it, to see everybody get it together.
The legacies of apartheid, the enormous social and economic challenges of the young democracy, crime and corruption, the gap between rich and poor, and the disillusionment with the ANC leadership are the topics of Gordimer's latest novels. She continues to be an activist for social justice and freedom of expression, a staunch critic of the Protection of State Information Bill, a law that the ANC government is pushing for. For Gordimer, it's a fallback into the censorship of the past regime, endangering the freedom of the press and restricting the access of citizens to crucial information.
And of course, what is behind it all is even more disillusioning, and that is the amount of corruption in high circles. The people in power want to do what they like, and they don't want to be reproached, and they don't want to be brought to account for the fact that while we still have thousands and thousands of people homeless or living in bad conditions. So it's very disillusioning if one is a member of the ANC to see the ANC indulging in these completely wrong actions, and indeed especially repetition of some of the aspects of apartheid.
Many South Africans have left the country, including some of her fellow writers. Gordimer's described the conflicting thoughts of immigration several times in her novels, but for her personally it was never an option to leave, neither during apartheid nor after an attack by robbers in her house a few years ago, or the disappointment with the current government.
I belong here, and this is an assertion as a white, which sometimes has been laughed at by my black acquaintances, not my comrades.
Nadine Gordimer's life and work are inseparably entangled with her home country. Her convictions haven't changed. She continues to be one of the most influential voices in South Africa. For Monocle in Johannesburg, I'm Leonie March.
Thanks, Leonie, and you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. And it's not over yet. We still have some more great a cappella tracks from Vive, a meeting with another master of the pen, Santiago Roncagliolo, and a visit to a Miami gallery with a difference. Glorious. So back to our six-piece a cappella geniuses, Vive, who along with some original material also plucked this cover out of the archive. Remember the Lighthouse family? Well, here's their track High, like you've never heard it before. After the set, Paul Noble sat down with them to talk about getting your pipes going first thing in the morning.
High. one day we're gonna get so high, high. Though it's darker than December, what's ahead is a different color. One day we're gonna get so high, high. The end of the day, remember the days when we were close to the end. I wonder how we made it through the night. The end of the day, remember the way we stayed so close to the end.
We are gonna be forever, you and me. You will always keep me flying high in the sky of love.
Remember the ways when we were close to the end. I wonder how we made it through the night. The end of the day, remember the way we sang so close to the end. We'll remember it was me and you.
Cause we are gonna be forever you.
Hello all.
Hey.
Hey.
That was absolutely fantastic. Was that a bit early in the morning for hardcore vocal workouts?
Yeah, we're around each other a lot, so it's not the first time that we've had to sing at scary times in the morning.
As a type of music, it's very complex because you're here playing at the EFG London Jazz Festival and the music's very jazzy and you've all got a jazz background.
Mm.
But unlike going to a jazz club where there's a bunch of musicians playing the standards and off they go and everyone has a session, this is highly regimented, complex arrangements where everyone needs to know what they're doing at the exact time. Is there any room in that to break out and bust out a little solo?
It's interesting. You're absolutely right in saying it is very regimented. It's funny because we all come from a background where we have primarily been improvisers. And of course, we love to throw it in our set sometimes. I believe Vive is fundamentally a jazz group beneath all the other stylistic features we like to, you know, mix and diversify our sound with. However, with this in mind, we love to come back to jazz, and we do have songs in our set where we can't help ourselves but try and, you know, bring something new every gig, just for our own interest, of course, because as you can imagine, we spend a lot of time with the same material. But of course, I think that's part of the joy is performing such regimented material. We do enjoy that also, so it's like a two different things that we get to involve ourselves in.
And is Vive a dictatorship, or is it a democracy? Do people get to pitch in harmonising ideas and suggestions for tracks you're going to do?
The start point, well, it's usually either, you know, me or James will just have a tune and we'll record it down, and then we'll show the group. And, you know, we'll get...
I think the notes are the initial phase, which that's obviously the main foundation of all our work. But then once it comes to the rehearsal room and we've learnt all the notes, that's when the work begins, and that's when we input all of our own, like, kind of ideas. And that it takes sometimes, like, 1 or 2 months to get the song how we want it, with all the dynamics and all the blend.
Tamperings.
So once something's in your repertoire, it's there to stay.
Yes.
A cappella obviously has this long tradition going back to Barbershop and the Whiff and Puffs and the Swingle Singers and so on. But there's also this competitive element to it, which there isn't in virtually any other kind of music. That a big part of the genre is singing competitions and sing-offs. And obviously a whole bunch of people who didn't know about it now know about it through Pitch Perfect, which I loved, I have to say. What do you think it is about just this pure a cappella that invites the element of competition?
I think the fact that it's purely voices, there's something incredibly human and
personal as well.
Personal, right, about something that's produced just from your own body and nothing else. And it's something that everyone can do as well. It's something that feels like you're taking a lead part, but you're also part of a harmony part. I can see why there's definitely an element of sportsmanship, but you know,
I mean, it's quite a physical thing to perform as well.
It is
demanding.
Entertaining and it's TV.
I wouldn't say athletic, but it sometimes feels that way.
I mean, that kind of attitude often creeps sometimes into rehearsals where we'll sort of compete against certain, you know, like different parts, like lower parts and upper parts. Yeah. But you know, I would definitely say our approach is very cooperative as a whole. You know, we definitely enjoy the like athleticism that has seemingly like
it did look very athletic from
right something like that yeah. But no, I mean, I think that's the incredible thing about a cappella is it's cooperative and competitive.
That was Viv talking to Paul Noble, and they're playing at the EFG London Jazz Festival this week at the Royal Albert Hall, the Barbican and the Forge. Head to their website vivvocals.com for further information. One more track from them still to come in the show. What show? It's Culture with me, Robert Bound. Santiago Roncalliolo is an award-winning Peruvian writer whose work has been translated into 13 languages. His debut novel, Pudor, was made into a feature-length film, and his second novel, Abril Rojo, won the Premio Alfaguara in 2006 and the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize, much easier to pronounce, in 2011. While he specializes in fictional thrillers, he's also delved into the world of non-fiction. In 2007, he published La Cuarta Espada, which focuses on Abimael Guzman, one of the most dangerous terrorists in the history of the Americas. Earlier this year, he released his latest work, Hi, This is Conchita, written entirely as a series of phone conversations, with each voice represented by a number in place of a name. And New York bureau chief Santiago Tarditi caught up with him recently over coffee to talk about his career so far.
You grew up in Peru, you were born in Peru, and then you moved to Mexico, and you traveled across Latin America growing up, and you were always in touch with different Latin American cultures at a time when the region was undergoing political and social changes. How has that experience shaped your life and your writing?
Well, I really have written about many places in Latin America. I have books settled in Argentina and in Caribbean and in Miami, which is part of Latin America. It's our colony here. And of course in Peru, but I don't feel it like many countries. I mean, we're very, very similar, and it's true we are a region. I went to India last year and they had 32 languages, each one with a different writing, like 8 major religions, and if they are a country, we could perfectly be a country. It's a big, very big country.
What do you think unites us all? What is the common denominator between all the countries?
Speaking Spanish and being near United States, it's enough as an identity. I guess we have the similar problems and a very similar culture, which is a mix of the worst parts of European Catholicism with the worst parts of American capitalism. And that's us, more or less. And that builds a very similar culture and a very similar way of thinking anywhere in Latin America.
I read somewhere that when you were young, you felt you had like a revolutionary need, kind of like a revolutionary heart. And then moving back to Peru, you realized that there was actually a revolution underway, but it was the wrong kind of revolution because it was the Shining Path who was fighting against the government. How was it for you going back to Peru during those days and realizing that this revolution wasn't as romantic as you thought?
Well, it was not just for me, but for my parents and many people coming from the left wing in Latin America. The Shining Path revolution was a big disappointment about the concept of revolution. But maybe they were especially killers and especially assassins, and violence in Peru was especially horrible. But more or less the same thing was happening all around Latin America, all the disappointment of the guerrilla, which was a big illusion in the 60s. And right now it's very funny because you see our presidents in Latin America are the former guerrilla guys, like the Uruguayan guy or nationalist left-wing army people like Hugo Chavez, all these people. They are our capitalists. They are the people managing the economic growth and dealing with market and the global market. You go to Spain, where I live now, we have a classical right-wing president, and he nationalized a bank, raised taxes, and make a fully more left-wing policies than the Latin American left-wingers. We have a very strange world right now, really.
You're here in New York for a few days as an ambassador of Spanish language and also to talk about your latest book. Take us through its main topic and explain who is Conchita.
Well, Conchita is a sex worker, phone sex worker. She's the character of one of the stories of this little novel. Hi, this is Conchita. It's kind of a black comedy of crossing stories of people talking by the phone. It's a guy in love with a sex telephone worker. Another guy leaving messages to his ex-girlfriend in the recording machine all day, leaving messages in the recording machine. A guy trying to get his wife killed by a paid assassin, but the assassin is totally useless and very stupid. And somehow it's a story about one of my obsessions with this incommunication, the impossibility to really connect with other people. Many of my characters in many of my books, even in the social books, are like isolated and having problems to communicate. And this is a black comedy about this, exactly.
I wanted to ask you about your experiences of writing in Latin America when you were growing up and now being based in Barcelona. You were telling me about your studio in El Borne and how every morning you walk through the zoo, the city zoo, and through the old part of town and you get a lot of inspiration from that. Is it very different for you to write from, say, Lima or Medellin or Mexico City and writing from Barcelona, or is everything kind of along the same line?
I love the life I can have in Barcelona, the my personal life, the way I live. But there is not a difference for writing, I would say. You know, the good thing of my job is you can write anywhere. But it's true that the more you travel, the more you understand about people and about difference with people, and therefore the more you can write about. When you travel, you must reshape yourself. You must change and adaptate to the society you live in and understand it and reinvent yourself. And that's exactly what you do when you write. It's the same than when you travel. I really enjoy and I really learn from traveling, and maybe that's why I always writing about different places. I just realized that I never repeated a location in my novels, but it was not conscient. It was just when you find stimulus, you write about this stimulus you've got, and traveling is always for me the most important creative stimulus.
That was Santiago Roncagliolo talking to our New York bureau chief, Santiago Tarditi. Up next on The Culture Show, a very homely art gallery.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Art dealer and curator Carol Jazar does more than offer drawings, paintings, video and sculpture in a clean white box. Her home gallery is highly respected by collectors and artists from Miami and far beyond, but it's not located in the Gucci-laden design district or in trendy Wynwood. To see what's on offer and meet the soft-spoken proprietor, you must drive to a quiet Miami neighborhood called El Portal. There, you'll find yourself enveloped by mango and avocado trees, palms and flowers. Monocle contributor George Fishman paid Carol a visit to see her current exhibition, Palimpsest, which features artist William Cordova as guest curator.
I'm a French citizen. I was born in France from Lebanese parents. And I grew up in Brittany, where I studied. And I came to United States 22 years ago. I met few artist friends that were complaining to me that they had no venues where they could show their work. I started curating shows for them in different venues. It ranged from cafe, restaurants on South Beach, empty commercial buildings. So since I was moving from one location to another, I've noticed that the spaces, I mean, the physical spaces, the architecture influenced a lot the way we looked at art. So yeah, several years ago, I purchased this property with the house and a separated two-car garage and a big lush yard. Lots of fruit trees. The location is different, the approach is different. I'm trying to pioneer something more organic. I'm making a living out of selling art, but I see myself not only as a salesperson. Yeah, my responsibility for the artist, I would say, is the same as any commercial gallery. I want to exhibit their work and to promote their work just like any other commercial spaces. But I feel like I have a responsibility also to the viewer. You see, now we're in the garden, and if you breathe, can you smell all the different fragrance? And you hear also, you hear the sound of nature, the crickets, mosquitoes here and there, and from far away, the cars passing by. So we are in the heart of the city, but still it's like being in the country.
My name is William Cordova, Peruvian born, and I am an interdisciplinary artist, cultural practitioner, and currently installing an exhibition at Carol Jazar Fine Art.
I know that curating is part of his practice, and I enjoyed working with him.
Palimpsest is this last 12 years of, in a way, erasure of the many grassroots organizations, that momentum that was cut short. So a lot of people in this exhibition, like Gary Moore, Purvis Young, Duane Kolodny, they were here. They were in the trenches. They're still in the trenches. So it's important to also acknowledge those generations. A lot of artists from other cities, other countries, other states don't know anything about that history. From a distance, Miami is Art Basel, nothing else.
I enjoyed the collaboration with William because I like his idea and I like his aesthetic. And I feel like a show like Palimpsest is a perfect venue here because it's off the beaten path. It's small work, it will require a one-on-one relationship between viewer and work. And the fact that it's next to a garden, viewer will be able to reflect on that work.
I think the most important part is the intimacy of the space, the location. It's not in any commercial community where that screaming, it ends up all negating each other. You remove yourself from that and come to any exhibition at Carol's, and you'll have a very different experience because it slows down one's visual experience and it becomes very intimate. You walk outside of the space and you see all this plant life. And what it does is creates this buffer.
Well, I mean, it's a wonderful thing to have a home gallery because I'm able to live with art. Viewer can come inside the house when we have opening or when they come visit the gallery. So they can see the work in a home setting. The trade-off is as soon as I wake up, I'm at work. We are at home when we're in nature, when we're in a garden. So here it's home, it's my home, but it's also home, you know, in a Sanskrit way. That's what I'm trying to pair, art and that feeling of being home. The work itself doesn't have to be spiritual work, the experience is going to be spiritual. People will not coming in, just look like that really fast and say, oh yeah, I saw the show now.
sometimes when you're in a train, it's going too fast, you can't see anything. It's all a blur and you won't remember anything. When the train stops, you finally see everything, crystallizes.
William Cordova ending that report there from Miami by George Fishman. If you're interested in finding out more about the Carol Jazar Gallery, just go to cjazzart.com. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Next week, we'll be getting a tour around the new Rough Trade store in New York City and finding out why information is beautiful. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, produced as always by Katie Bilboa. Closing the show, here's this week's Midori House session, the sixth voices of Vive with Let Me Think About It. Thanks, dear listeners, for tuning in.
You walk towards the door with a disregard for fantasy. So turn around and see what you've become to me. See what you are to me. The reason for ambush is the sky. But you and I are separate. Now I've got something left for you to see. Once I get you motivated,
the fight begins before a chance can come for us. A memory distracted by all you have ever.
Finally, I said,
but the lattice would not move you close to me.
Where you went now I've got something.
Ba-dee-ba-dee-ya-ya. Ta-ta-ba-dee-ba-dee-ya-ya.